Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Visit a live archaeological dig site on the very grounds where America began. Or walk the fields where our country was won. Live like a colonial by day or track 18th century ghosts by night. For all the history to be found here, there's plenty more to make for yourself. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.
Having a team feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
Scared to Death is explicit in every way. Please take care while listening.
Whether thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no home, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul, whatever thou be until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles. I'm Dan.
Hey, Dan. I'm Lindsay.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
We are in a winter wonderland in early, the very start of November as we record this. So much snow in
Coeur d'Alene. So much snow. It just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like they said, oh, it's going to snow. It's like 5 inches.
I think it was 70 degrees like a week and a half ago.
What?
Now snow.
I know, but it's going to go away quick too.
I have two quick things to say before our stories today. So much story. And then Lindsay has a very important announcement for this year's annual Giving Tree. So don't miss that.
Woohoo!
Real quick. Sorry I butchered the pronunciation of La Petisola a few weeks ago. I have no idea why I started throwing an extra S in there. I did go back and listen because I'm like, I think I knew how to say that. And I was like, what was I saying? So I did look it up. I did write the correct pronunciation guide into my notes and then said something else. So La Petisola, sometimes when I try to extra hard to get a word right that I'm not like familiar with, then I think I get a little extra anxious about screwing it up, which increases the odds that I do screw it up.
Right, because you become so hyper-focused on it and you're like, wait, which way was the right way?
So despite my best efforts, did mess that up. So sorry if it took anybody out of the story. And then this week's merch drop, better posed as a question. What if aliens really did visit us for the first Thanksgiving in October of 1621? And if they did, what if they never left?
Oh, my.
Head on over to check out the new Alien Pilgrim tee and poster. Loving the three red eyes, shiny medallion, and the classic pilgrim hat. Check out the cool artwork at badmagicmerch.com.
I want everyone to buy it and then wear it. I hope that you have like a conservative family that doesn't appreciate the spoops. And then you wear that to Thanksgiving dinner. Just like a really uptight family. That's
you
like,
have a family of pilgrims. Just a puritanical family. Like they still dress like that.
If you're a wasp, oh my god, it'd be so great.
All right, let's hear about this annual Giving Tree.
Yes, and before I dive into that, just as a quick aside, as you all know, November we always do a veteran charity. So this month, just as a small reminder, before I dive into the Giving Tree information, this year we are donating to the United Heroes League. And if you'd like to learn more about that or how you can get involved, please visit unitedheroesleague.org. And now, it is time for the fourth annual Bad Magic Giving Tree. I cannot believe this is the fourth year of doing this. I was recalling all the years and what they felt like. And this year feels so awesome. I'm very excited. It's our chance to collectively give back to our own community. It's such a cool thing that we do every year. Makes me so happy. And like all previous years, we will be using the December Patreon donation to kick this off. We estimate that that amount will be about $15,000, as in years past. If fans would like to also donate, that's kind of how this all happened. We were going to do it. And then the first year fans were like, well, I want to help. And so then it grew to be so much bigger than what we ever thought it could be. If you are wanting to donate. The only way we're accepting donations is through Amazon gift cards. That's how we will shop for the families. It's the most effective way. And you can do that by going to Amazon.com and then, you know, buying a gift card. I'm sure you've done this before. When it asks whom you're sending the gift card to, you're going to enter in the email address GivingTree2022, the numbers, GivingTree2022 at badmagicproductions.com. And that's how you'll send money. We'll receive it and then we'll apply it to the Giving Tree. And as in years past, for every donation that you guys make, Dan and I personally, not part of the Patreon money, just of our own money, will match dollar for dollar whatever you guys donate up to $15,000. And we're excited and proud to be able to do that. And then the next part, possibly the most important part, for those of you who are looking for some help this holiday season, here's how you become a recipient of the Bad Magic Giving Tree. In years past, it's been this like chaotic thing, like send in an email and we'll pick names from a hat. And that's a really awful place to be in. Having been a kid on the receiving end of a giving tree, I know that when we were entered into that, we just automatically got help. So sitting and waiting to find out if you've got help is not helpful if the answer is no, because you need to find other resources. So this year, we're going to switch it up a little bit. What you're going to do is on Monday, November 21st at 12 noon Pacific time, you will go to badmagicmerch.com. There's going to be a large banner about the Giving Tree. You're going to click on that and it's going to link you out to an application. We're using SurveyMonkey, so it's going to look like a survey, but that's your application. You're going to go there, you're going to fill it out, and then boom, you're in. Now, we can only take 50 families, so we're really asking you to be honest with yourself and with our community about your needs. And if you happen to go to the website and you click on it and it says this survey is full, that means that we've already got our 50 families. So there's no way to apply without receiving help. I hope that that is fairly clear. So again, that is Monday, November 21st at 12 noon Pacific time. That's when it will open. And the application will be open for 50 families or until November 26th, whichever comes first. And that's it.
Yep.
I hope that's all clear and concise.
And look to social media. If you have questions, look to social media, Instagram, Facebook, Ask Out of Death podcast, and then just read the episode description. Yeah, it's too lengthy of a description for us to keep hitting it show after show.
Yeah.
So go back, listen to that part of the episode, and there you go.
Two thumbs up.
How much horror do you have for us today?
I have two hoes.
Two hoes.
I do. I have two great stories. My first story will take us in honor of like Veterans Month. We're going to go to a veterans home, you know, like a sort of like a nursing home kind of facility type thing, but for veterans.
Oh, yeah.
We have a very interesting poltergeist, maybe. Maybe it's haunted. A very interesting little, a very wild, cool, and interesting tale there. And then our second story, I'm so scared of this. I had such a hard time sleeping. A possible UFO sighting. And it feels like there's a pretty broad amount of confirmation on it as well.
Okay.
It's weird.
Okay. Very, very cool. I'm excited to hear those stories. I have a giant story and a normal sized story. First story is just so weird. Not the scariest story I've come across for me, but something new and fun to talk about in the world of what if. What if you're being haunted? Not by a ghost, but by someone living in the same space as you, but in a different time. Not a different place, just different time, like a parallel dimension that somehow intersects with this dimension, historical timeline-wise, like this looping time.
Okay.
Someone living in the past, but also living while you're living. It's a weird concept, and it'll make more sense as I get into it once I tell the story.
Okay. I'm confused, but I like it.
Yeah, and the second story, much more traditionally scary, one of Hawaii's most haunted homes, or at least it used to be before it was demolished, the Kaimuki House.
Kaimuki.
Oddly, both stories of mine today have a character in them with the last name of Cummins. Same spelling and everything, but no relation that I know of.
That you know of. Look at these cute socks. These came in a Halloween box from fans April and Brandon Park. They're like little like mummy monsters. They're so cute.
Thanks, April and Brandon.
Thanks, guys. And also thanks for the dots and the Tootsie Rolls.
And thanks, everyone that sends them in that don't get named. Sometimes in the hustle and bustle of just organizing everything, you know, we don't always have the name when the sock is presented.
Well, and quite honestly, a lot of y'all are sending them from Amazon. And yeah, so you can't trust Amazon to put that gift receipt in there.
Totally. Okay, a little bit of setup. Then I'm off and telling this odd tale. In the mid-1980s, in the rural English village of Dodelson, a young economics teacher named Ken Webster and his even younger wife, Deborah, found themselves caught up in a very atypical and ongoing paranormal experience. What started off as a confusing encounter soon became frightening and then transitioned into one of the most unusual and intense existential experiences I've ever come across. It was an experience that challenged everything the Websters thought they knew about the world around them. Time now for the tale of the Doddleston messages. In November of 1984, Ken Webster picked up his friend Nikki from the train station. They taught at the same school together, and Nikki was just returning from volunteering in Africa and needed somewhere to stay for a few weeks. Ken and his wife Deborah, a newly married couple, just moved into a small cottage and were currently doing renovations. They made room for Nikki and took her up on her offer to help with painting the place. That night, all three of them were hard at work, each focused on painting a section of one of the walls, when suddenly Nikki stopped what she was doing. She'd come across what seemed to be a strange-looking footprint on the wall, and she couldn't for the life of her figure out how it had been placed where she saw it. It had been placed at such an odd angle and so high up on the wall. Also, although it did look like a human foot, it had six toes. When Nikki asked about it, Ken said it was there when he and Deborah moved in, and they had no idea how it got there. He asked Nikki to paint over it, and she did. Nice, thick coat. But after they all retired to bed for the evening, Ken got up to use the bathroom and was surprised and a little disturbed to find a fresh footprint had reappeared right where Nikki had painted over it. So he painted over it again. This reappearing footprint was the first in a long line of highly unusual paranormal phenomena. 2 days later, the footprint now staying covered up, the three friends awoke to find that all the cans of cat food in the house had been neatly arranged into a pyramid overnight. Ken and Deborah first thought that someone, maybe Nikki, was playing some sort of practical joke on them. Nikki assumed Ken or Deborah had done it, but no one would admit to being the prankster. Ken did have a musician friend named Johnny that had access to the house. He sometimes came over when no one else was home to practice guitar, but only during the day, when Ken and Deborah were at work. Ken was 99.9% certain that Johnny would never sneak inside his house in the middle of the night. 2 nights later, he'd become 100% certain Johnny wasn't the one who made the pyramid, nor anyone else he knew. He, Deborah, and Nikki had been sitting in the living room for a couple of hours when they entered the kitchen to find another tower. This time, it was made of an assortment of different items. Cat food, two liter lemonade bottles, and kitchen towels. The items were all balanced on top of each other precariously in such a way that would have been nearly impossible for anyone to achieve. All three of them now very uneasy. Because they'd all been in the kitchen earlier in the evening and then all been together in the living room, they knew that one of them hadn't done it. They were also certain they would have heard someone else come in to do it. Had someone else been hiding in the house for several hours at least? Had someone been breaking into the house and hiding just to try to scare them with weird food arrangements? That seemed highly unlikely. But what else could it be? They weren't ready to look towards paranormal possibilities quite yet. Now the trio became afraid to enter the kitchen. What would they see next? They tried to convince each other and themselves that nothing nefarious was going on, just someone had to be messing with them. They all now tried to ignore the two strange arrangements of items in the kitchen and the reappearing footprint that seemed content now to stay under the latest coat of paint. And they decided to go about their normal lives. For a short while, they didn't encounter anything else unusual or hard to explain, and life went back to normal. A few weeks into things calming down, Nikki mentioned a project she was working on for school, and Ken suggested she use a word processor. The school he worked at had a number of BBC microcomputers, old forerunners to the modern desktop computer. The school often loaned one or two of the machines out to teachers, and Ken offered to get one for her. And the machine was delivered to his cottage the next day. And here's where the story starts to get really weird. One Sunday evening in December, Ken, Nikki, and Deborah left to visit a friend for a few hours. When they arrived home, Ken noticed the computer was turned on. He was surprised. He was positive he'd shut it off before they left. Ken sat down in front of the computer and saw a file on the screen named KDN. He thought it probably wasn't one of Nikki's files because she usually named all her projects with individual letters. Curious, Ken clicked open the file and started reading. Ken, Deb, Nick. True are the nightmares of a person that fears. Safe are the bodies of the silent world. Turn, pretty flower, turn toward the sun, for you shall grow and sow. But the flower reaches too high and withers in the burning light. Get out your bricks. Pussycat, pussycat went to London to seek fame and fortune. Faith must not be lost, for this shall be your redeemer. By now, Deborah and Nikki were standing behind Ken, also reading the screen, equally as perplexed. They all had questions. They all also felt a general sense of unease. Who was messing with them? Ken now returned the word processor to the school since Nikki was leaving to visit her family for Christmas and wouldn't need the machine after that anyway. After the holidays, she'd be moving into a new place of her own. The machine was now out of the house, but the strangeness doesn't stop. The day before Nikki was due to leave, she walked into the kitchen to find cans of beer stacked into another tower. Ken wondered again if Nikki was behind all this somehow. But then after she left town, the towers continued appearing in the kitchen almost every day. Ken and Deborah continued to live in a state of general unease. The only thing that really kept them from reaching out to the authorities was that whoever was messing with them hadn't done anything threatening. They took their key back from Johnny, explaining that they had to figure out what was going on. They changed their locks. The towers kept appearing. Ken then borrowed another computer from the school a few months after all this started, in February of 1985. And the following evening, he took Deborah out for a Sunday drive. When they got back home, he again noticed the computer was turned on when he was sure he'd turned it off. He looked at the screen, saw another new file, this one named Reate, R-E-A-T-E. A sense of dread ran through him as he sat down to read its contents. I write on behalf of men. What strange words thou speak, although I must confess that I hath also been ill-schooled. Sometimes methinks alterations somewhat barful, for they break mine a slopes in mine bed. Thou art goodly man who hath fanciful woman who dwell in mine home. I hath no want to affray, for only sith mine half-whited antic has ripen a twain, mine bound hath I been wreathed a knight. I hath seen many alterations, lastly charge house and thou home. Tis a fitting place with lights, which devil maketh and costly things that only mine friend Edmund Grey can afford, or the king himself. 'Twas a great crime to hath bribed mine house. L.W. The message left the Websters with so many questions. It was either full of terrible misspellings or had been written in a very old form of English. There were a few words that neither Ken nor Deborah had ever heard of or knew the meaning of. Now, for the first time, they started to really consider the possibility that some sort of spirit was in their house. If somehow there was an entity living in their home and speaking through the word processor, it seemed like this entity believed that the cottage was their home. The next day at work, Ken approached his colleague, Peter Trender, with his account of all the recent events at the cottage. Peter was extremely open-minded, had a vast knowledge of anything pertaining to the English language. Ken was hoping he could either date the language in the message from LW, or at least translate some of the words for him. Peter was fascinated by the story, and did provide an analysis of the words and the grammar, dating the language all the way back to the 17th century. He requested copies of any future messages should they appear, and promised to analyze them as well. Further intrigued, Ken now also contacted his good friend and history buff, solicitor John Cummins. John came over that night to take a look at the message, and he helped craft a response. Could they communicate with whoever had written it? Ken created a new file and wrote the following message. In the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, dear LW, thank you for your message. We are sorry for disturbing you. What would you like us to do? Did you live in a house on this land around 1620? Do you want us to tell you more about our time? Why write a poem? Who is Edmund Grey? Is he related to the Edgerton family? Is the King James or Charles Stuart? What is the charge house? Was the village called Doddleston in your life, and how many families lived there? Thank you very much for your messages. Thank you for not making us afraid, Ken, Deborah, and John. The following afternoon, upon Ken returning home from work, something else incredible happened. Ken and Deborah received a response. Ken called John and read the message aloud to him. 'Twas an honest farm of oak and stone. It is helpful that you should tell me about thy time. Dost thou have a horse? Edmund Grey, brother of John Grey, lives at Kinnerton Hall. Thy king, of course, is Henry VIII, who is 46. I need woot of King James. Mine charge house is a place of lure. L.W. 28 March Anno 1521. After some research and analysis, Ken felt skeptical about the information in this last message. Kinnerton Hall was supposedly built in the 17th century, not the 16th, and there was no historic records of a John or an Edmund Grey in Doddleston in the 16th century. Henry VIII was also not 46 years old in 1521, he was 30. All this led Ken back to thinking that maybe this whole thing was a prank after all. But who was going through the trouble of taking a joke this far? If the writer really was a spirit from the 16th century, the language itself at least checked out. After writing another response, Ken now received the next message on the 16th of February. The screen was full of text. The writer sent a very long message asking once again, amongst so many other questions, why Ken was in his house, and recounting various aspects of his life. The writer signed the message as Lucas. Lucas informed Ken he had no family and that his wife had passed sometime earlier while carrying their unborn child. Lucas mentioned that the house he lived in had red stone footings. This particular detail stood out to Ken. When he first moved into the cottage, he was doing some renovation work in the garden. He dug up an old pile of redstone blocks. Ken was not aware of anyone else who knew this information, not even Deborah. On Monday the 18th, Ken responded again at approximately 9:30 a.m. By the time he got home at 5:30 p.m., Lucas had already responded. Lucas seemed agitated by Ken's many questions in this message and also requested that Deborah play her flute more. Said he enjoyed the sound. He signed this message with the full name, Lucas Wainman. Armed with this new information, Deborah encouraged Ken to go to the local library to try to get information about Lucas. After a few hours of research, they came up with nothing. The couple was determined to find something that proved this wasn't all just some elaborate hoax, though. Ken and Deborah went to stay at John Cummings' flat in Islington, eager to talk to someone also fascinated by all of this and possibly get some help. John had been reading Poltergeist by Colin Wilson and had some interesting theories, but Ken didn't really like any of them. John explained that poltergeist activity is usually caused by psychic reactions from the mind of a frustrated teenager. Deborah was only 19 years old at this time, but she was happy with her life and marriage. I said she was younger. The second theory they discussed was ley lines. If two ley lines intersect, it can supposedly attract negative entities to that location. Ken, a skeptic, also was reluctant to believe this theory. Ken returned the computer to the school again, but now the poltergeist activity continued. But now instead of mysterious pyramids appearing in the kitchen, he and Deborah started to witness objects moving about and floating around on their own. This was no practical joke. No explanation made sense other than the paranormal at this point. Ken and Deborah were now constantly on edge. They were tired and scared to sleep with the lights off, but also couldn't fall asleep with the lights on. Things got so bad that Deborah moved out before she had a full-on nervous breakdown. She rented a small cottage in nearby East Green to get away from this all. Ken refused to leave. He desperately wanted some answers. He was determined to find out exactly what was happening. Soon after Deborah began staying in the new cottage, Ken returned home from work to find a floppy disk on the kitchen windowsill that had come out of its paper wrapper. The disk was named Lucas. Ken got the chills. Now Lucas was somehow writing his name on floppy disks? And how did he get these disks? Once again, Ken borrowed a computer from the school. Not long after plugging the machine back in, a new message arrived, followed by another. Lucas went on to tell Ken more about his life and things he enjoyed doing. Lucas wrote that he had moved to the area because the tax was low, but now a new sheriff was giving him trouble and some locals were accusing him of witchcraft and divination because they heard he had been talking to Ken through a concealed device. The last messages left Ken reeling. The events Lucas wrote about were not taking place in a past life. They were taking place while the two were communicating. Ken had previously assumed Lucas was in a spirit of a man long dead. But now it seemed as if Lucas was alive at the same time as Ken, but that the two were simultaneously existing about 400 years apart in the same place. Ken wondered why Lucas kept referring to the computer as a concealed device when it was very much on display in the kitchen. Ken wrote a response, left a picture of his Jaguar, or his horseless cart, as he called it, next to the computer in hopes that Lucas could somehow see it. Ken expected a response, but he wasn't ready for what he saw when he approached the computer. The picture of his car was brittle and black now around the edges, as if it had been burned. Lucas seemed amazed and confused about the car, writing that it looked nice, but Ken wouldn't get far without horses. Accompanying that message was one of his favorite recipes that he wanted to share with Ken. It seemed like Lucas wanted to be his friend. Ken now met with his colleague Peter Trinder again, giving him a rundown of these recent events. Peter suggested Ken get in touch with the Society for Psychical Research and have them do a full-on investigation. Ken agreed and reached out. The SPR seemed disinterested because there was no way to rule out Ken and Deborah as the source of the messages. An SPR representative told them if they could get further witness testimony, more than just Nikki, they would look into the case. Was this experience too strange, even for paranormal investigators? After this rejection, things began to take an even stranger turn. Lucas now wrote that he had a female friend who did not care for Deborah, who had now returned to spending most of her time with Ken in the original cottage. Shortly after that message, Deborah began to feel something cold, touching, and squeezing her on a regular basis. She also began having vivid dreams involving seeing Lucas in the kitchen. One morning, she awoke from one of these dreams to find his name scrawled across a beam in the kitchen. Once again, terrified that things could escalate even further, Deborah started spending more time at the other cottage. Ken and Peter Trinder now went on a trip to Brasenose College in Oxford to further investigate all this. Lucas had told Ken he'd studied there. Ken hoped to find a record of Lucas and his classmates, something to prove he was a real man. But again, Ken found nothing. Soon, though, Ken would receive a new clue regarding this mystery. On the 4th of April, Lucas told Ken that he'd been advised by a friend to use a fake name and change certain details about his life because he didn't know if he could trust Ken. Lucas now felt that Ken was trustworthy, but still didn't reveal his full name in this message. In order to try to get the SPR on board to investigate, Ken and Deborah now invited her mother and brother to stay at the main cottage for a little while. Deborah's mother would end up submitting the following testimony to the SPR. My son and I arrived at Meadow Cottage at approximately 7:45 p.m. on the 15th of April, 1985. After a few minutes, a friend of Mr. Webster's called at the front door for something. After a few words were exchanged between my daughter and the caller, he left and we three, my daughter, my son, and myself, went into the kitchen. We checked the windows and doors in the kitchen and bathroom. The back door was locked with a chain on the inside. The windows were closed, including skylights, though we did not have time to check if they were locked. We then gave our attention to the computer. All previous entries on the disk were inspected. Deborah typed a few lines on the screen, and as far as we know, nothing was entered after that. At 8:03 p.m., we went to the living room, closing the door behind us. I noted that the light had been left on inside the kitchen. We settled down, quietly reading or writing and occasionally speaking. I was not listening intently for noises. This was unnecessary as we were very quiet ourselves, but I did hear one or two noises that seemed to be coming from the kitchen. The sort of noise a mouse might make. I felt cold at times, and at one stage was shivering. We all kept our coats on as there was no fire in the hearth. We went into the kitchen again at 9 p.m. Deborah left a weight on one of the keys to scroll the screen because she needed the bathroom, and there didn't appear to be anything entered since we left it last. After a minute, we were startled by a high-pitched noise coming from the computer. This indicated to Deborah, I believe, that something had been entered. She swiftly came to the computer, and we all saw a new entry displayed, starting with the poem. We were short on time, and I was unable to understand that all that was entered at the time, but I did manage to read one or two lines, and we then left the cottage. Lucas had written them again. A new witness was there to verify. Two new witnesses. They waited to see how the SPR would respond. On the 22nd of April, another new message appeared on the computer. This time, it was not from Lucas, but came from someone calling themselves John. After analyzing former correspondence, Deborah and Ken were certain that John was the sheriff. John informed them that Lucas had been arrested on charges of witchcraft. What is happening in this story? Emotionally invested now in all of this, Deborah was concerned for Lucas and told Ken to reply to the sheriff and request to speak with him. If the sheriff could see the device they were using to communicate with them, they might be able to convince him to release Lucas. Deborah and Ken later received a message from Lucas, who appeared to be having a difficult time. Rumors had been circulating around town that Lucas was communicating with demons. Lucas now also mentioned something else Ken found rather curious. You said your time be 1985. Me thought you were from 2109, like the old friend, 2109. Ken decided to try out the only idea he had and wrote on the computer screen, calling 2109. After this, he composed a letter to the sheriff, playing on superstition in order to try to get Lucas freed from prison. And then the first response came in from someone calling themselves 2109. Ken, Deb, Peter. We are sorry, we can only give you two choices. One, that you either have your predicament explained in such a non-rhyme way that you may have instant understanding but cause what should not be to happen, or two, try to understand that you three have a purpose that shall in your lifetime change the face of history. We, 2109, must not affect your thoughts directly, but give you some sort of guidance that will allow room for your own destiny. All we can say is that we are all part of the same God, whatever he, it is. The cryptic message left Ken reeling. Could he really be living in 1985 and talking to others in the years 1521 and 2109 at the same time? Or was this all a trick, as a friend of his suggested? Was he communicating not with any real people or spirits of deceased people? Was he being manipulated into engaging with some kind of entity, perhaps even something demonic? Who or what was he playing games with? If he was communicating with real people in different times, he was at least, soon left with some comfort to find out that his letter to the sheriff had apparently worked. Although Lucas was still awaiting trial, he was released from jail and put on house arrest. Also, the SPR now finally responded to Ken and Deborah. However, their interest was fleeting. They visited the Webster's house a few times, taped up the doors and windows of the kitchen, waited for pyramids or a message to appear, but soon decided there was just not enough evidence that Ken and Deborah hadn't written a series of Word documents themselves. This was devastating to Deborah. She'd been spending most nights at the second cottage and was sick of either being separated from her husband or terrified. She was reaching her wit's end with poltergeist activity. One day in May, she went home to feed the cats and was greeted with almost every item the couple owned stacked against the walls of the living room, and she quickly fled the house. By the time Ken got back, everything was in its place, as if it had never been moved. After a few weeks of not hearing from Lucas, Ken was starting to get worried. He felt You know, he was responsible for the predicament that Lucas was in, awaiting trial, charged with witchcraft. In the 1500s, that could easily lead to the end of a man's life. Ken decided to write a message to 2109 and also wrote another letter to John the Sheriff. Lucas is a good man and does not deserve to die. We are not devils, but we have power. Lucas must not die. He must be set free to live at his house, and then we will speak as friends. We too fear for your soul if Lucas is to die at your hands. The threat of eternal damnation seemed to do the trick. All charges against Lucas were dropped. However, Lucas's life didn't improve. The local landowner evicted Lucas from his home. In August, Ken finally decided to ask Lucas about all the poltergeist activity in his house. To his surprise, Lucas told him he'd been having the same experiences and assumed Ken was causing the strange activity in his house. They decided that 2109 must be responsible and decided they needed a way to communicate where 2109 couldn't intercept their messages.
Oh my God.
Ken left a pen and paper out every night now. Somehow, Lucas managed to write a message on this paper. This time, Lucas signed his name as Thomas. It didn't take long for Ken and his colleague Peter to at long last find out who was on the other side of these odd messages. They determined that Lucas was a local man named Thomas Howarden. Peter had suspected it was him from small bits of information given him over the months. They found Thomas's college records and confirmed he was indeed a student at Brano's College until he was expelled for expunging the name of the Pope. Lucas, or rather Thomas, later confirmed this information. After communicating with Lucas via pen and paper for a while, Ken awoke to find his computer in the bathroom now. Where the computer normally sat was a written message in chalk. Ken knew from the wording it was from 2109. The cryptic message read, "One more chance. Measure frequency by +2 energy. What else other than sound or light?" Once the computer was back in its original position, Ken now found more messages. 2109 was not pleased about the secret correspondence between Ken and Lucas. Ken and Lucas continued writing back and forth on paper, trying to avoid the watchful presence of 2109. While discussing older messages, they came to the conclusion that 2109 was editing their messages to each other, and in some cases sending entirely false messages, claiming to be the other person. Lucas and Ken developed a strong bond. Both were upset that their communication would end in November when Lucas was scheduled to be evicted. Ken was convinced that someone or some group or something was using them as an experiment. One night in September, Ken received yet another message from 2109 with the name and number of an investigator it seemed they wanted Ken to get in touch with. Ken called the number, and the number was answered by UFO researcher Gary Rowe.
Oh my God.
Who met them at a local pub to discuss his story. Gary wrote a note, sealed it inside a brown envelope, asked Ken to place it on top of the computer without opening or reading it. Ken obeyed. 2109 then asked Ken to print out a response without reading it and seal it in an envelope to give to Gary. To this day, Ken does not know what was in those envelopes. Gary's openly said that the experience changed his entire outlook on everything. And to this day, he is still majorly affected by the events that took place in 1985. What was all this? Meanwhile, knowing his time with Lucas was coming to an end, Ken decided to ask Lucas how he discovered the computer. Lucas was rather confused about the concept of a computer and explained he had no keys to type words. He said that one night he awoke to see a green light illuminating his fireplace. He claimed that a man walked out from that light, told him to be strong and keep his faith. When the man left, there was now a magical machine in his home. For Lucas, the machine was just a small screen, and when he spoke, his words appeared on it. The last message from Lucas inevitably came and was extremely touching. He talked about his future plans, how one day he was certain they would find a way to sit and have a meal together by the river in Oxford. Both Ken and Lucas agreed to write a book about their experiences one day. And then Ken received his final message from 2109. "There is another person to come. They will be the help you need. You will know when they come." Thomas did eventually write his book and died shortly after. He placed it in a secure place. It shouldn't take too many years to find it. Though he wrote it in Latin, with help from a friend he met in Oxford. The inscription reads, "Me writes this in the hopes that mine friends will one day find this book. Then may our lands be not so distant. We will finish now. You have a lot of work to do. There is no need for you to write back, as we will have gone. Thank you for your cooperation. 2109. After this last message, all was quiet, and seems to have remained quiet ever since. Ken wrote a book titled The Vertical Plane, published in 1989. It was recently republished earlier this year. Ken is still searching for the book Lucas wrote. He allegedly keeps a binder with over 300 messages from Lucas. Says he still lays awake at night wondering who or what 2109 is, what influence they had over his relationship with Lucas, and most importantly, he wonders if communication across time is truly possible, or if, again, he never communicated with any people or any spirits of people at all, but something else entirely.
What the hell?
What the fuck is going on in that story?
That is insane. First of all, it's so hard not to laugh at some of the moments.
I know, it's just like, what is happening?
This is not plausible. I cannot believe that this is not a movie.
I know. It is getting more attention. I was not familiar with this story. And when I was looking at sources, it's been showing up, you know, and some YouTubers have told, you know, parts of this story. Again, the book was republished this year. So it seems to have...
Is Mr. Ballin talking about it?
I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily his wheelhouse, but it's gotten more like renewed interest. So
who knows? Freaking weird. Yeah, so weird.
And I know it's not like the scariest, but there are elements of paranormal terror, like when she's being touched, Deborah, by an invisible entity.
Oh, totally.
And when they're being harassed, things moved around, you know, just like not knowing if someone's like, you know, been breaking into their house, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, no, I think it absolutely fits the vibe here because, I mean, I'm going to tell you a story with a possible UFO. So it's like, to me, 2109, okay, who else could it be other than aliens?
I don't understand anything about this. Yeah.
That would be the craziest long con and so intricate and so complex and to what satisfaction. At no point does somebody come out and go, ha ha, gotcha. And then it's really funny and it's like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. I can't believe you did that. No.
And if Ken and Deborah were making this up, I mean, which they could have, I mean, all these stories, that's of course always a possibility.
Sure.
What a weird story to make up.
Also, maybe they're brilliant storytellers.
If
you
so
thought
atypical.
This up and followed through and the computer and you got Nikki involved and you got her mom and her brother involved. And I mean, it's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And to like have no detail messed up where you're like, wait a second, doesn't line up.
And to have the messages be so like, what are they even saying in those? Like that
nine, blah, 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 F, schnish.
I would think if you made it up, you would gravitate towards being scarier. With the messages or threaten, have some kind of like narrative angle. Not that you have to, but I mean, to me, I don't know what to think of this story.
Are Ken and Deborah still married?
There's almost no information about them since the release of this book. You can't find any information about Deborah, to my knowledge, anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken, I couldn't even find a picture of the author.
Uh-huh.
There's the book.
Okay, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. There's so much weird shit about this.
Well, okay, that off the cuff. I suppose that leads me more down the path that is completely made up because if you can't find Ken and Deborah, to me, that's like, okay, maybe Ken exists, but Deborah never existed. And that's just a character that he made up in this story and or somebody entirely separate of them wrote this. And those are just characters in a story they wrote. But they don't want to be grilled about it because they're like, they know that holes will be poked in it.
Yeah, it could be that, or it could also lead people to believe the other way, where it's like, clearly Ken Webster wasn't seeking fame.
That's fair.
You know, because like, there's been no publicity tour, none of that.
No
that
movie.
Nothing, you know, just like, just the story just came out, and that was kind of it. And doesn't seem to have followed up with other stories that I'm aware of.
In 1985, I mean, that's not even that long ago.
Mm-hmm. But definitely long enough for them to keep chunking away at more stories, trying to get more notoriety now that this thing's having a resurgence, to do interviews and things. I don't even know if they're alive.
What a bizarre thing.
A couple pictures. And again, you can check this out at Scared to Death Podcast on Instagram or Facebook. This first one, cover of Ken Webster's book, The Vertical Plane, if you want to do a much deeper dive on all this.
Okay, so there's the book, but you couldn't find pictures of him? He doesn't have an about the author page?
If he does, I mean, I couldn't. There was no ebook version that I was able to find.
Yeah.
It was like a paperback he had to order.
Mm.
Maybe it's in there. No one just, you know, like has thrown it up on the internet.
That seems.
The Gary Rowe, I had to find him on Facebook. He's not a UFO researcher of like huge. No, this is just from his own Facebook page.
Yeah. Just like his personal.
Yeah. And he has like maybe 200 friends. He's not like a big social media. It's like he's not trying to get famous off this. Here's another picture of a possible extraterrestrial actor, Gary Busey. I just like pictures of Gary Busey.
Oh, God. What kind of mental illness does he have?
Well, if we want to get sad, I think he was in a motorcycle accident,
right?
had a brain injury.
Okay, yeah, because I was like, there is something.
But I also want to say he was, had a brain injury, but was pretty Gary Busey before the brain injury.
When did the brain, do you know?
I don't remember. Well, quite a while ago,
okay.
But I hired him on Cameo once to send a birthday message to our friend Doug Mellard, and he killed it. He did a great job.
Didn't his son then also join in?
Yeah, Jake Busey's also on, but not in the song. God. But Jake Busey had his own cameo account.
No, I thought that Jake.
I didn't get the two of them on the
jumped
message.
Into. Oh, wait. I think I have it wrong. I think that Doug then sent you back a message from Jake.
Oh, that's what it was. I believe Doug hired Jake Busey to send me a birthday
greeting. What a silly thing. My gosh. I have a weird Gary Busey story, but I feel bad now because I didn't know about the car accident.
Yeah.
One of my friends worked with him in production and he was not a clean individual.
Yeah.
But yeah that might have been post.
But nice.
Yeah, but nice.
But then there was, now there's recent, I don't want to get into a Gary Busey wormhole because now there's recent allegations he did some creepy stuff.
Oh, no.
Let's skip on past old Busey.
Oh, Gary, why'd you bring him into this? This is all your fault, Cummins.
I thought it would be a weird pick. We move on. And then this is a pick of the BBC microcomputer that Ken possibly used to correspond with someone from the past. Early, like pre-Apple IIe kind of computer.
I mean, okay. So then Thomas/Lucas is saying like this green box showed up in my fireplace.
Uh-huh. Dude came out of his fireplace.
Did he use the word fireplace? Because I don't feel like they would have called it that in that era.
I might have not been quoting him there. I might have been paraphrasing. I can't remember.
Okay. So, but this green box shows up that he talks to and then it spits out his words. Oh, after something walked out of it and told him to like.
Keep the faith.
Keep the faith?
Yeah, this story is all over the place.
And who's 2109?
No one knows.
Okay, it's very weird.
Is Ken Webster Gary Busey?
Is Gary Busey 2109?
There's unlimited possibilities with this story.
My God. You could have one of those.
Are you
like,
2109? Am I 2109? Am I Gary Busey?
I have something to tell you.
Nothing makes sense anymore. I'm having an existential crisis now.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Now I'm on stage with you and you're like, what is a line? What's the point of a line? Dan was doing a funny new bit in Austin this past weekend and he just is like going off about lines. Like, what does it mean to stand in a line?
Yeah.
So silly.
Yeah.
Weirdo.
Are you ready to get to a more typically scary story now or do you have more questions about this? I mean, we could probably talk about this for hours.
Oh, I feel.
I don't know if we'd get anywhere.
We wouldn't get anywhere. I just want to say one thing.
Yeah.
Especially like for newer listeners who haven't listened to the back catalog, when you were talking about possibly someone being hidden in the house, I immediately thought of the Denver Spider-Man. And that is such a good episode.
Yeah. And I can't remember which episode which number that is. Cause you know, we don't title them necessarily by the story.
No, but you can find
it. Yeah, that was, yeah, actually the Google's gotten so much better. It's so funny. Now, a lot of times when I'm looking up creepy characters, our videos come up constantly.
You're like, hey guys, not helpful.
And I don't know how it does it, but it like, it
probably
just,
tags.
Well, no. What it'll do is it'll show you the time code automatically where you say this thing. So it's using voice recognition and then cataloging it based on that. Like it's just getting more futuristic.
I can't go down that hole because it's so like Big Brother's watching. Mm-hmm. It freaks me out.
But the Denver Spider-Man, I love that story because it was that mix of really unusual true crime that led to really unusual and terrifying paranormal lore.
Just the premise, if you don't know, is a tiny man living in the attic of a house.
And at night, following people around.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
oh, yeah. God, it's so creepy.
Okay. Ready to get into that scarier story now?
Yeah.
Before moving on, we first need to take a quick mid-show story sponsor break. What is the most basic gift you have ever given the moms in your life for Mother's Day? Flowers? A candle, some random knickknack you picked up at the last minute because you completely spaced Mother's Day?
I have definitely made the mistake of procrastinating gifts for Mother's Day. And then, like the Friday before, I run to whatever store is open and convince myself that yes, my mom does need another coffee mug that declares she's the world's best. So lame.
This year, how about one upping yourself by giving the moms in your life an Aura picture frame? Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to any mom at any age. Aura frames connect easily to Wi-Fi and have unlimited storage so you can share as many pictures as you want.
This year, as many of you know, I am on a spending freeze, but one of my carve-outs was meaningful gifts for the people I love. I don't want to give all of the moms in our lives something that won't bring them joy. We are giving Aura frames to the moms in our world because they are timeless, heartwarming gifts.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code SCARED at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We each have an internal battery that gets depleted and charged based on our own interactions with the world. Some of us feel the most recharged after spending time with people we love. Some of us feel absolutely drained after these interactions. I bet a lot of you are like me. You sometimes are drained and you are sometimes invigorated. Sometimes you need total quiet and alone time, while other times you need to spend time out in the world.
Mostly, I am drained by long bouts of interaction with other people, just anyone, even the ones that I love the most. Even if I'm doing something I love, I still find myself feeling socially burnt out. By the time I get home, I need to be alone, be quiet for a little while, so my battery can recharge. It can be hard for me to remember that I do love having social interactions because I know that the price I will pay is sometimes to be exhausted.
While we both have different needs for interaction and different ways of recharging, we both realize that we need to get out into the world. We need time with other people who offer us unique perspectives on the world. Staying home and only being with one another, while enticing, is not necessarily healthy. It leaves us in a very specific echo chamber. Each of us has been working with our BetterHelp therapist, and that has been really helpful for us to understand the other person's needs and to respect their boundaries when they simply need time to recharge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/scaredtodeath today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/scaredtodeath.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, which means you need to sort out your gift situation ASAP, creeps and peepers. The mom figures in your life have stories to tell about how they became who they are today, from hilarious to heartfelt, from silly to spoopy.
This year, give the perfect gift for Mother's Day, a gift that will capture all of the memories of the moms in your life forever. Give her StoryWorth. Each week for an entire year, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question. When the questions are complete, StoryWorth compiles the answers and creates a stunning storybook that you can cherish for all time.
My brother is going to be so irritated with me. I actually bought my mom's StoryWorth last year, and the end result was so incredible. And then as I was reading my mom's story, I found myself jotting down new questions that I wanted to ask of her. So this year, I'm going to gift it to her again. Because here's the thing. At the end of the day, we are always wishing we could have asked our loved ones just one more question. So why not ask them now? I'm really pumped for this second round of StoryWorth with my mom. I know I will never regret reading her stories.
Give all of the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you'll all cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/scared. That's StoryWorth.com/scared to save $10 on your first purchase. Thanks for listening to our sponsor deals, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you use some of them and save some money. Okay, so here we go with the second story. Hawaii is a beautiful setting.
Man, take me there.
Yeah, for most people, including Lindsay and I, Hawaii is mostly associated with relaxing and wonderful vacations. A warm, inviting, scenic, romantic, and tranquil destination where you can enjoy nature, a welcoming local culture, fine cuisine, recharge your batteries, lots of sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've learned here on Scared to Death, also a place full of reports of numerous and terrifying encounters with the paranormal. The Kaimuki House was once the location for numerous of these encounters. And the duplex recently built in its place may still provide horror stories in the future. Located in the Kaimuki neighborhood of Honolulu, the infamous original Kaimuki House, located on the corner of 8th and Harding Streets, was once one of the most haunted places in Honolulu before it was demolished in 2016. Numerous families who attempted to live in the original Kaimuki House ended up fleeing in terror. Reports of it being haunted go at least as far back as the late 1930s.
Wow.
Yeah, no one seems to be sure when the house was built, but doing a little digging into the history of the Kaimuki neighborhood, that area didn't really become populated with suburban homes until the early 20th century. So there's a very good chance that the home wasn't built until the 1930s. The first known report of haunted activity could have easily come from one of the first handful of residents of the home, a young, newly married couple. Time now for the tale of the angry spirits of Hawaii's Kaimuki House. Shortly after they moved in, their neighbors heard loud bangs, crashes, and screams. The neighbors called the police to report a possible domestic violence incident, but when the police got there, the husband and wife both said they were being attacked by invisible forces. And the couple moved away shortly after that incident. In 1942, police were called to the house again after a woman living there called and frantically told them, "She's trying to kill my children." When the police entered the house, they incredibly claimed to see the woman's three children levitating off the floor, being hit and thrown around by an invisible force. An invisible force the mother claimed to have witnessed, a female sinister spirit of some kind. The Honolulu Star Bulletin reported this incident on August 13, 1942, titling their article, "Police Called to Shoo Ghost from Kaimuki." Kahuna, Hawaii's own witchcraft, brewed evils once again Wednesday night, dispelling old-timers' hopes that the war had stilled it. Answering a Kaimuki near riot call at 1:25 a.m., Police Sergeant Mosley K. Cummins and Patrolman Robert Ansteth found a Hawaiian boy 10 and his two sisters, 18 and 20, shrieking on a sofa. Their mother, besides shrieking herself, was waving tea leaves and sprinkling Hawaiian salt to ward off ghosts. At 10 p.m., she said, her son had detected an odor of ghosts. Angry at being found out, the spirits first attacked him, then began repeated attempts to strangle his sister, she said. After a 1.5 hour struggle, police and family yielded the home to Kahuna and retreated at 3 a.m. to the mother's sister's home. This family moved out, and then the house sat empty for many years. Those who did live there in the ensuing few decades never stayed long. 3 decades after that last attack that made the local papers, the next newspaper report of a resident claiming to be attacked inside the house surfaced. The terrifying story of this attack was published in the 1972 Halloween publication of the Honolulu Star Bulletin, titled Spook Stories. Said a patrol officer on patrol in Kaimuki received a phone call from 3 young women who all lived together in the Kaimuki house. They told the officer that after they'd been hearing strange noises of someone moving around and talking, an invisible entity grabbed one of them by the arm. She and her friends were absolutely terrified, so after breaking free from this thing's claw-like grip, they decided to go to one of their mother's houses. They wanted the police officer to follow them to make sure they got there safely. The 3 women all got into their car, and the police officer followed them down the road. Not far from their home, one of the girls was attacked again, the girl who'd previously been grabbed inside the Kaimuki house. The police officer witnessed the woman in the middle front seat suddenly fighting off someone who could not be seen, but who was strangling her. The officer stopped his car, jumped out to help her, reached into the girl's car to try and get whatever was choking this woman to leave her alone, but couldn't. The officer later said, "A big, strong, calloused hand that could not possibly belong to a teenage girl grabbed my arm and twisted it. I radioed for assistance." A responding officer arrived at the scene later and said he was prepared for a parking lot fight, but not for a ghost. That police officer would later tell a journalist, "There was a ghost in that car." By the time the second officer arrived, all 3 women were in complete hysterics. The backup officer ordered the woman, who was being choked and manhandled, when the entity inexplicably stopped attacking her, to get into his police car. The other 2 women would drive behind them along to their destination, but as soon as the woman sat down in his squad car, it died and wouldn't start back up. The woman then returned to her friend's car, and then as soon as she climbed inside it, miraculously the squad car started up again. They all decided to proceed down the road, keep heading towards the station, but they'd only made it about 5 yards out of the parking lot when the woman's car door flew open and the woman who had been attacked now fell out onto the road. Whatever had choked her before, whatever had grabbed her inside the house, now it was back and it was dragging her. She was tearing at her throat as if someone was choking her. Both police officers, working together, still weren't strong enough to pull invisible hands away from the dying woman's throat and stop this thing from dragging her. One of the officers now ran into a nearby cafe, grabbed Hawaiian salt and water, ran back with it. He sprayed the girl being attacked and dragged and everyone else with it, and calm was immediately restored. The officer later told a reporter, "It's something my grandmother taught me. I never tried it before. It sends the ghosts away." Where did this attacking entity come from? What made the Kaimuki house become so haunted? Some suspect that the Kaimuki house became haunted after a father, the man who had the house built, murdered his wife and both his children inside the home. Allegedly, his wife and son were buried in the backyard, and their bodies were later recovered, but the daughter's body was never found. And these are not the only reports of murders occurring inside the home in its early years. Another story of a double homicide involves a female couple who supposedly lived in the home. One of the women had an affair with a man, and when the man found out that his girlfriend already had a partner, he murdered them both, then took his own life inside the home. 6 possible murders, all in the home's early history. Are these murders what led to the home being haunted, or did these murders occur because of something already haunting the home? Many familiar with these stories seem to believe that the first murders may have lured, or the first murderer may have lured an entity into infesting the home, and that entity then had a part in the subsequent murders and in all the subsequent claims of the building being haunted. The most popular theory regarding what this entity is that it is a kasha. Kasha is a dangerous spirit from Japanese folklore. The kasha is a type of entity that steals corpses. A and targets people who accumulate evil deeds. And after perhaps targeting the first murderer, this man-eating ghost, this ghoul who typically lives around crematoriums and feeds on the dead, often described as a cat-like demon from the sky who steals away bodies, may have decided to stay in the Kaimuki house. The original Kaimuki house was torn down in 2016, and the house has since been replaced by a two-story duplex. But the new property may still be haunted. Writer Keith Mann lived in one of the units in the duplex for a year with roommates not long after it was rebuilt. He wrote that he and a friend were desperate for a place to live, made a hasty, impulsive decision. Finding a place to rent in Honolulu is a nightmare, he said, so you tend to gloss over a lot of negatives, including a corpse-eating demon roommate. After searching for a place to live, he learned about a brand new duplex in Kaimuki where some mutual friends lived. Keith didn't realize he was living in the location of the Kaimuki house until after he moved in. He and his new roommates established three rules regarding living on haunted ground: no Ouija boards, no Halloween parties, no challenging the ghost or tempting fate. They lived in the house for a year without much incident, and the landlord and his family who lived above them said they also weren't completely plagued by paranormal happenings. However, a few times during his year in the house, Keith would wake up at exactly 4:33 a.m., quote, as if I had just been injected with adrenaline. And on these occasions, all the smoke alarms in the place went off at the same time, even though there was no fire and none of the alarms were connected to one another. They were all battery operated, put in different rooms. No one alarm was connected in any way to any of the others. So what were the odds that they would all go off at the same time and on multiple occasions? Ken also said that on numerous occasions, his room would be much colder than the rest of the house and that he often woke up with a sense of anxiety and wrongness. He said he always kept his AC unit in his room set to 72 degrees, but on the mornings he woke up in a fright, the room barely reached 60 degrees. Ken wrote, "The room temperature wasn't the haunting part. It was the cold feeling in my chest. It felt like being stabbed by a white walker. My veins were filled with ice water, and I thought my life force was being drained out of me. My chest was so tight, I struggled to breathe. No matter what I told myself to calm down, the feeling crept through me like a virus until I could barely move. You know the feeling you get when somebody is staring at you? When your instincts alert you, even when you can't see the person? It was like that." Whenever this happened, Keith would run out of his bedroom to the living room and would be afraid to go back into his room. He never saw anything paranormal, but always felt like something wasn't right. And that happened a total of four times during Keith's year in the new Kaimuki house. Neighbors later told him that no one had ever stayed in the Kaimuki house for more than 3 months. Keith Mann had his strange experiences about every 3 months. Coincidence? Keith believes that tearing down the original structure somehow dimmed the powers of the spirits that haunted the piece of land, the Kasha or whatever they are, and hopefully he's right, and no one will be attacked or strangled or dragged by an unseen force or murdered by a fellow human in the new and apparently still haunted Kaimuki house.
Can you rent it like Airbnb? That's what they should be doing.
They should Airbnb to get the paranormal enthusiasts?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there's so much of that over there. I don't know.
Oh, man. The idea of an entirely invisible force trying to choke you to death is petrifying.
I know. I was just thinking about that, police officer. Like, if you witnessed someone get dragged out of a car by something you can't see while they're being strangled. Oh man, that's sticking with you forever.
Forever.
You're waking up in the middle of the night thinking about that at different points in your life for the rest of your life. And, yeah. And of course, if that happens to you, even worse.
How do you sleep? How do you rest? How do
no
you
shit.
Like, yeah, what a, I mean, it's just, the idea that this police officer tried to get this invisible force off of her and then felt something grab him. I don't know. It's just that thing of like not being able to defend yourself and or as a police officer, protect, right? That's
Totally.
You serve and protect. So like, what do you even grab at?
I don't know.
But the salt water, I thought that was very smart. And it made me think that this past weekend, Priscilla and Jonathan brought me some Florida water. And I'm like, oh, is that what's in Florida water? I cannot exactly remember, but man, we should probably be carrying that on us at all times in case there's a sudden invisible force.
I have a few pictures. Nothing really spooky. I mean, I just have a picture of the original Kaimuki house.
Okay, just like a totally normal house.
Yep.
Like a pretty standard.
Yeah, pretty standard house. And then this next one, this is the, I found just off of, putting in the address and using Google Maps. This is the Kaimuki house today.
Blue skies.
I know. It looks so nice over there.
It's so cold outside.
I know. To get the pronunciation, I was watching a realtor video from somebody in Honolulu. And it's just like,
did you buy a house?
No, but it does. I've never been. We've never been to that island.
No.
But it looks so cool.
Next year, though.
Yeah, hopefully you can do a show over there.
We're trying to come for you guys.
And then finally, just the Kasha spirit from Japanese folklore. Just a little sketch.
Now, have we covered the Kasha spirit?
Not this one, no, because it's a very, usually it shows up in stories as, yeah, this cat entity, like this cat demon entity that basically like ferries people to hell.
Yeah.
Who have made terrible choices in life. It shows up in lists of like the weirdest spirits from, you know, Japanese folklore.
Okay, I think I have it confused with, I forget which culture it is. I thought it was Japanese, where it's like villages and like the, it's like specifically a man-eating demon.
Oh, in the Philippines. That like really black-skinned, oily-skinned man kind of.
The oil-skinned man or whatever. Man.
Yeah, it might even be called that, but I think, I remember that story. From, yeah, Philippine folklore.
There's something else. What's
Filipino
the folklore? Kashtuka?
I don't know.
Kashtaka.
Oh, the Kashtaka.
Yeah. I don't remember what it does.
That's the otter man, right, Logan? That's from Alaska Inuit folklore.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So many creatures from so many places in the world.
Why do they all start with K? okay. Florida water. Oh, yeah. And those levitating kids.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Dude.
Showing up in the newspaper article like that.
Oh my gosh.
The police claiming to witness that.
I wonder if per capita, on average, if police officers in Hawaii get more calls for possible paranormal occurrences than anywhere else.
Like anywhere else in the States?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would suspect there's a good chance of that because, you know, so much of it is cultural or
That's
seems
what
to
I was
be.
Thinking,
and,
yeah.
You know, and again, like Japanese culture, way more than. You know, U.S. culture on average mm-hmm. is interested in the spirit world mm-hmm. and interested in ghosts and that kind of, you know, folklore.
Yeah.
And there's, Japanese culture is so tied to Hawaii's culture just because there has been so many Japanese people that have lived there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
True story. Whew. My chest feels a little heavy from that last one. Also, I'm still thinking about the weird computer 2901 or whatever.
2109.
What the heck?
I don't know.
That is so trippy.
I mean, if that story somehow is real, it's just such a weird commentary or like just to get like a perspective on how time works
mm-hmm.
and how the past and that, I mean, because, you know, there are people who believe that and people who theorize that whole like time is a circle and more circular, not like a straight line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That somehow you could be in some spot where like the past and the present and the future call all kind of like intersect with one another.
Like some weird like portal, like you're just in the right place.
Yeah, like you could be talking to somebody in a completely different time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is your tattoo shedding?
No, I don't know. I got a bunch of white fuzzies all over my pants. I have no idea where they came from.
It might be from these guys.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Is your tattoo, how's it looking?
My arm is a little, I can't sore? Really, I'll have to show it on when it's healed more on Instagram or something.
Dan's got a new.
New from WillXX and a new, kind of horror, I guess, like tattoo, but it's a
Grim Reaper.
Grim
dude?
Reaper, but he's presenting. It's not complete. It's pretty complete, but it's mm-hmm. has those words. But a Grim Reaper presenting a little double helix.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not dead, man. I'm not killing you. I'm just transforming you.
Eek! I don't know how I feel about that. we can talk about that later. Woo, man. 2109. Listen, that's not that far away. I think that's like the part of the story that I was like, wait a second.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when we get to the year 2109? Is that who it is? Is that when the future and the past and the present all collide? Because it would no longer be the future if it was that year. But you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yee gee wow wow. Feel a little squish squish over there.
I do.
Hello, Layla. Oh, Layla. Okay. Well, let's move on to some other kinds of horror.
Let's do it.
Okay. So we have covered definitely for sure various kinds of like care facilities, like nursing homes, mm-hmm. Like mental care facilities for the elderly or just, you know, mental health in general. Like, I don't even know like what you call it now. Like we would have called it an insane asylum, but, you know, just those places seem to have a reasonable amount of death in general. Even if it's like a place where like old people or people in general go to like rehab a hip, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, at a certain point in your life, those kinds of injuries can kind of take you out.
Yeah.
And so we've really been here before, but this, I don't know, it just, it seems like more often than not, there's paranormal activity at them. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because of the death or is it because of the kind of like work that's going on there or like old hospitals that are repurposed.
I don't know.
But it's this story definitely made me like, all right.
Good.
I don't want to be in a old folks home. Literally ever. So if you ditch me there, just know that if I die there, I'm not going to stay there and haunt people. I'm going to find you and haunt you for ditching me there.
All right.
Okay, fair enough.
Fair enough.
All right. Let's see what this former healthcare facility worker has to share. Hello, Dan and Lindsay. My roommate introduced me to Scared to Death, and I've been addicted to it ever since. I've been connected to spirits and the unknown for as long as I can remember. And it's nice to hear others' stories that prove that I'm not crazy, even when no one else would listen to me. A few years ago, I took a job as a security officer at a veterans home. The home is a place for those who cannot care for themselves, but there is also a section for highly functioning veterans who are working towards leaving the home and are there for other reasons such as addiction or other mental health needs. Mortality isn't as commonplace as it is in other such places, but it is high enough that there is a whiteboard that tracks the number of deaths of current and former residents, and the board gets one or two new entries a month. When I took the job, I was warned that some people think the place is haunted, and the company gets a lot of turnover because people can't handle it. I'm a bit paranoid of the paranormal because I've always been a lightning rod for paranormal activity. A story I always remember from when I was young is that my grandpa had recently died, and I was sitting in the living room of my grandma's house watching TV when I heard something moving in the family room, which was just down the hall and down a small flight of stairs. Being the curious child I was, I got up and went to the family room only to see my grandpa in the living room holding a flower. He winked at me, smiled, and placed the flower on the fireplace. He put his fingers to his lips in a hush motion and then walked out the door and disappeared. He never said a word to me, and I never said a word to my grandma about it. She found the flower later that day after I'd gone home. She always told my family that Papa had brought it for her. I knew she was right, and she knew she was right too, even though my family doubted it. That experience, along with a few others I had, gave me pause before taking this job. I feared the worst, but my paranormal experiences had always been pleasant, and the job did pay well. On my first day, my training officer, the only other guard at the home, walked me around the grounds and gave me a little bit of history about the place. Before becoming a veterans home, it was a psychiatric hospital, as in the lobotomy kind.
Man.
I asked if the place was haunted, and he looked me dead in the eyes in the most serious voice I'd ever heard, and he said, "Yes, it is very haunted. But don't worry, the ghosts are nice." Both everyone who worked and lived there agreed the place was haunted. During that first shift, shortly after he told me about the ghosts, the elevator doors opened on their own, almost as if the ghosts were confirming their presence. I didn't really think anything of it at the time. However, it did become a regular occurrence. The elevators opened on their own seemingly randomly, though not always. Whenever this one resident walked towards the elevators, the doors would open, even though he never pushed the call button. He would hop inside and say, "Thank you, Casper." He did this almost as a nightly routine. Other things were happening in another building that housed a game room for the guests. It had arcade machines, a skee ball machine, and a pool table. I would go in there at night and find the games playing themselves. I wrote it off as an electrical short or something of that matter. I tried to find logical reasons to debunk what I was seeing. I had always written off all that was happening when a new nurse in the facility asked me if the place was haunted. I said that, yeah, weird things certainly happen, but it was old and probably just had to do with electrical problems. The next day, I got ready for my 16-hour shift, a shift that would be the single most terrifying experience in my life. I came to work and everything was normal. I did my patrols, chilled out in the security office, ate my lunch, patrolled some more. Nothing crazy, but when the night hit, something changed. The home is lonelier at night as there's only one guard and two nurses. The residents are mostly sleeping and no other staff is around. I went to the game room to lock it up, just like I did every night. When I walked in, the machines went crazy, but they always did, so I was entirely unfazed. I walked to the end of the long hall and locked the door, then walked back and locked the front door. As I turned around, a puzzle on a table flung itself off the table and onto the floor. I kind of laughed it off and got into the elevator. The elevator takes you down to this network of tunnels that run underneath the entirety of the veterans' home for fast travel for employees. Some of these tunnels were certainly creepy, dimly lit, barely enough height to walk and a crouch. But this particular tunnel was extremely well lit, and even the residents used it to get to the game room. As I walked down the tunnel towards the main building, I heard footsteps following me. I turned around thinking maybe I had missed a patient in the game room during my patrol, but no one was there. I made it to the end of the hall and locked the door, and as I did every night, I did so without hearing any more footsteps. I walked down the hall past the elevator. It opened on its own, as it often did. I never took the elevator during my patrol, though. I always took the stairs. So I walked past the nurse's station, waving to the night nurse, and on the second floor, I walked past the elevator again. Nobody had gotten on it, but it was now on the second floor, and the doors opened as I walked past. I was mildly concerned as I walked to the third floor. The elevator was there when I passed it, and again it opened with no one inside. And again, this pattern repeated itself on the fourth floor. I walked back down the stairs from the fourth floor and came out by the nurse's station. One of the night nurses said I looked white as a ghost and asked if I was okay. I told her what I saw, but she just laughed at me and said, "I think you're making them angry." I went to the main lobby to use the restroom. No one else was in there. And right as I was about to leave the restroom, the door slammed shut in front of me and the lights went out. I fled as fast as I could, running outside. My patrol required going to a building across the street from the main building and now felt like a good time. I walked through that building without much incident and then walked back to the main building. As I approached, I heard a horrifying scream, a woman's scream. Once, twice, three times. It was coming from the back of the main building, so I entered the front, grabbed the head nurse, and we headed to the back to look around. No one was there, and no one else had heard anything. He told me I was letting things get to me. When we went back inside, I returned to the security office where I finished my patrol. Connected to the office was a training office for the staff. It was inaccessible except through the security office. Nobody was inside, and in fact, it was very rarely even used. I sat there playing on my phone when I heard the sound of a computer turning on, the familiar Windows startup sound ringing in my ears, the sound coming from the training room. The hair on the back of my neck stood up, but I just wrote it off. But then a second computer turned on, then a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. I heard a deep, low voice whisper, "Get out now." For the first time in my life, I felt actual fear from this paranormal encounter. I felt fear for my life in that moment. I got up and ran out to the nurse's office. I continued my night, but I never went back into the security office. And during my rest times, I sat in the break room watching TV, trying to forget what had happened. In the morning, I went around to do the unlocks, going back down the hall, unlocking the game room. As I walked through the room, the machine started acting up again, and then a pool ball flew across the room right past me. Not close enough that I thought it was aimed at me, but just close enough to send me a reminder. We are here and we are real. I never doubted ghosts again. I stayed at the job for a year. I refused to go into the game room alone after dark. And every time the machines went crazy, I would simply say hello to Casper. I told him that I could see him, and sometimes that was enough to make him stop. Casper was real, and for that one night, I feared that he was actually trying to hurt me. I've long since left that job, and nothing else has happened, but I feel immense sadness when I think about it. I'm afraid to talk about it to others because I assume they'll think I'm crazy. Maybe sharing my story will help others who are afraid to talk about their experiences but want someone to tell. Thanks for everything you do, some random girl on the internet.
Thanks, some random girl on the internet. All the electrical stuff in that story, like the elevator and the computers and the game room, like just things like turning on or the elevator kind of like following her almost.
I know. I did not care for that part.
That is something that comes up in a lot of horror stories, like lights flickering.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, Logan, but I think there's still quite a bit of mystery around electricity.
Oh, yeah, dude. Yeah, so much mystery around electricity.
Yeah, like they don't know, like scientists don't know exactly how it forms and gets here. And,
like why it works?
Yeah. Like it is such a strange thing that like, you know, these thunderstorms, they can really, there's, natural electricity out in the atmosphere and that we were able to harness a version of that to try to actually like power things.
Right.
And create it through dams and different, like, but like, what the fuck is, I mean, I know people can like, electrical engineers can say, well, it's XYZ.
Yeah.
But what are XYZ? Like, how do we get this little magical lightning that is in our walls right now? And then what is interacting with it to make these changes? Like, how do spirits interact with it? It's so, even if it's not ghosts, let's say it's not ghosts. There's so many stories of weird electrical things happening around people that sure don't seem to be coincidence. And then you add like moving objects, like the pool table ball.
Yeah.
What is happening? Like I guess I'm in that headspace of with the poltergeist possibility of the first story I told, where the one guy's friend, Ken's friend, was like, well, maybe it's poltergeist activity because, you know, a lot of like disruption around emotionally upset teenagers.
Yeah.
They used to think that it had something to do with poltergeists. That's as weird to me as ghosts. How could emotional disruption affect like your
I get it.
A superhero somehow?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I can.
It's so weird.
I don't know that I can, you know, give you an explanation that is logical or entirely makes sense. But in my brain, the way I think about it is that we each have like a force field. We each have energy that we give off. It's like when you meet somebody, you're like, oh, they've got bad energy. I mean, we were at a restaurant in Austin and this woman walked in and I was like, fuck her. Like I instantly hated her. She had bad energy, but it's something you give off. And it's like, yeah, you could say like, oh, it's the way you walk. It's the way you talk. It's the way you present yourself. But isn't that your energy? Isn't that the thing that you're like releasing out into the universe? So if that is true, if we think about it from that angle, and if when we die, where does our energy go? Like if it's still hanging around, then theoretically it could interact with all these other things and cause reactions.
Because we are, you know, conductors, we can conduct electricity. It can flow through us, flow through us.
Totally. Like, think about like if you like go into like AFib and they have to like shock your heart. That's a shockwave. That's an energy
static
that's being
electricity.
Yeah, like put into your body to make your heart go boom, 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 boom.
Or
you know,
electrocutions when like
death penalties.
Well, I'm even thinking of like when people are holding hands and like a lightning bolt hits, but then it, like they conduct and it goes to the other one, and sometimes the person who it goes through is okay.
Yeah,
but the last person in line is the one like kind of
burnt
the most.
Why does it stop there? Yeah. Well, and then, like little things like when you like drag your like feet across the
floor. Static electricity.
Yeah, you touch a knob and it's like ooh.
And you were talking about that lady with bad energy. She was with some other lady. What I find fascinating is like there's going to be people who don't read her energy as bad. They have a similar energy, perhaps.
I didn't mind the other lady as much.
Right, but isn't it weird? Like their energy may resonate with each other. Like there are so many intangibles in life.
Oh, I see.
It's
what you
like
mean.
When you talk about somebody who just doesn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like why aren't you friends with so-so or with friends with so-and-so? And you can't fully articulate it. It's like, well, for lack of a better term, they just don't get it. They're just like awkward.
Well, our energies don't match.
Right. Like, yeah, you're just not in sync with one another.
Uh-huh.
And what,
Totally, because I've met plenty of people in my life where it's like, you're an entirely nice person. You're not even bad. Your energy's not even bad. We just we just don't click, as the saying goes. It's like, I like you. I could have dinner with you, but we're never going deep.
Yeah, you're attracted to some people on a friendship or romantic level for just reasons that you can't fully express, articulate. Yeah, there's so many unknowns still, which is so great.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that in terms of interacting with electricity as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even batteries are kind of weird.
all of it's weird.
Like this whole little system. I mean, I understand how a battery works, but like there are all these different variations of like, but what's really going on there?
Mm-hmm.
What if ghosts are the ones jacking up our electric bills? What's all their fault?
That's funny. Like if you had like a house that was just, you know, getting an unusually high electrical bill every month and it was because ghosts were siphoning off some of the energy using it for their own poltergeist activity type thing. Like that would be an interesting
study.
That'd
be hilarious.
Houses that claim high levels of poltergeist activity, what's their electric bill?
Oh my gosh. What's the meter read?
What's compared to the average electric bill?
Okay. I like that idea. Make it a little bit more scientific. So silly. So silly. Ugh. How do you feel about UFOs right now? Like, I'm still...
I always believe in them.
Okay. Are you terrified of them? Like, because both of our views and opinions on various different pieces of the paranormal or the unexplainable ebb and flow.
I think that there's numerous species out there in the universe just because of the numbers. There's so many different planets. And so I would just think that, you know, practically some of them are going to be good. Just like people, some people are good, some people are bad. That there's going to be some aliens who the way they would treat us would not be good.
Okay.
Just like the way we treat houseflies in general is not good. We just destroy them on site.
Oh,
there's going to be
a really good fly killer. Does that mean the aliens are coming for me?
Well, I think that there's going to be aliens who probably see us as nothing more than flies or something just to be killed. And there's going to be probably benevolent aliens who want to communicate and are curious about us. I would guess there's a whole gamut of aliens.
Does it scare you?
Nah, it doesn't work because like there's been no concrete proof of, like, I look at it like we all have to die eventually. Everyone's going to shed their mortal coil and go on to some new energy form or whatever. So that's coming for us all. If I get to pick a death, alien just takeover, pretty exciting way to go.
But possibly very painful.
Yeah, but still as you're dying this painful death, you're like, that's a fucking alien.
But also, what if no one never finds out that that's how you died? Then it's like all
for
naught.
That'd be a bummer. Yeah. I wouldn't want to die out alone in the woods getting attacked by one group of aliens. I would want to be part of a resistance force.
What is this, Star Wars?
Fighting off some alien takeover. Okay. And then if I die in that fight, that's a pretty cool death.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your take. I think for me, the alien thing, as with all things potentially paranormal, is it's always the factor of the unknown, right? That's why we're afraid of death, because it's unknown.
Yeah.
That's why sometimes people are afraid to travel to a new place or try a new food or go out with this new person. It's like fear of the unknown. What will happen if I... What will,
yeah,
right? And so I think that's what it is for me about aliens, is it's just, it feels like the least known, even though somehow it almost seems like it should be the most known, like that we have the most information about it. I don't know. Still super scared about them and was very uncomfortable going to sleep with this story in my head.
Okay.
All right. Hey, Dan and Lindsay, longtime fan here, and I'm excited to share a story with you that happened not too far from you guys. This story takes place about 30 years ago in the Bob Marshall Wilderness area outside of Lincoln, Montana. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I was not there for this story as I wasn't even born yet, but this story is like folklore to my family. My grandfather, some family friends, my dad, and all his siblings took a one-day camping trip into the wilderness area, a common and normal thing for my family to do, as they had a cabin on Sealy Lake and liked to go out for camping trips when they could. As I've been told before, everything was normal that night. As my grandfather got into bed, he heard the dogs going crazy. They wouldn't stop barking, so in an attempt to quiet them down, he went to check on them. As he gets out of his tent, he sees this insanely bright light at their campsite. Thinking it must be the park ranger and the root cause of the dogs barking, he heads towards the ranger's car to see what's going on. Maybe there's a bear near the campsite, or maybe they left some trash out. My grandfather isn't sure why the park ranger would be there so late at night. As it turns out, it wasn't a park ranger at all. As soon as my grandfather approaches the light, it was like he was transported to a different place. Suddenly, he was in this bright, white, sterile room. Then it felt like the room started to move. Like it was flying. He was freaking the fuck out. He's looking around, but it's so bright, he can't see anything. And as he gathers his senses a little, he starts to realize he isn't alone. Around him are the outlines of people or things. But again, it's so bright, all he could see were the vague shapes of what he thought were people surrounding him while he squints through half-shut eyes. He started to plead with these people or things, telling them that they had to take him back. He was yelling, saying he has kids and a wife who need him, and that whatever crazy thing he was a part of now, they needed to return him. And so they do. No questions asked. No words were said. The next day, my grandfather woke up in his tent thinking, wow, what a weird dream I had. He went through his day as if nothing happened. In his mind, nothing had happened, just a bad dream. As they packed up the campsite to head back down the mountain, my grandfather started to tell his friend about this dream. The friend, weirded out by the dream but not too concerned, said, "Well, the dogs were barking a lot last night, so maybe that triggered your dream?" My grandfather, not totally convinced, went along with it. Finally, after a long hike out, my grandfather, my dad, and his siblings arrived at the cabin where my grandma was waiting for them. Not one for camping, my grandma had decided to stay behind. My grandma could tell something was up with my grandfather, though when she questioned him, he told her the story. This bizarre look washes over her face. My grandfather, now stressed out even more, watched as she grabbed the newspaper from that morning and throws it down in front of him. On the paper's front page, it read, UFO spotted above Bob Marshall Wilderness Area last night. I try to take these stories with a grain of salt, but knowing my grandfather, I have a hard time believing he would lie about this. This was a man who was a World War II veteran, ran a business, and was as utterly no-nonsense as they come. Not to mention, Montana is well known for its UFO sightings. So I have to believe something happened that night. Stay spooky, Will.
Thanks, Will. The newspaper detail sells that story.
I know. It's like, yeah.
Otherwise, I would think just a dream.
Totally.
Yeah.
You would go through the rest of your life thinking like, oh, God, what did I have? What did I have to eat that night? I had too many beers. Like, whatever.
If that happened to me without the newspaper, I for sure, like you said, think it's a dream. With the newspaper, I for sure think I was abducted.
1,000%.
There wouldn't be a doubt in my mind.
And I love that it's like this older gentleman who has like lived through some shit. You know, he's not...
He doesn't need a new cool story, doesn't sound like.
No, he's got them all.
He's coming back from World War II and likely saw combat, all that.
Right, he's got stories he doesn't want to tell.
Yeah. He doesn't need a cool alien story. And just that whole like no-nonsense detail. And he's doing fine in life. He doesn't sound like he was desperate for attention.
Mm-mm. And it doesn't sound like he did anything with it other than tell his wife.
Doesn't sound like there's probably any other stories. This is like his story of this kind.
I love that it's family folklore. It's like, yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
That should be family folklore. You should be telling that every Halloween, every Christmas, every Thanksgiving, every Easter, every get together. Like that story never dies.
If my grandpa, like my grandpa Ward, my other grandpa was a little, would be more, I don't know that I would
eccentric?
Believe him. Just very, he was like a doomsday preacher basically.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well you're looking for things. You're looking for signs.
Yeah.
My grandpa Ward, not religious, not even, to my knowledge, was ever like spiritual, like him and his father-in-law, my great grandpa John, both like no nonsense. Just no bullshit guys.
Yeah.
No stories like that of any kind. And if one of them had a story of the paranormal, I would believe it.
100%.
Because they just, you know, to my knowledge, never made up anything, never exaggerated. If anything, played down stuff.
I'm just laughing in my head because I'm thinking about like the one super funny like story that I know about your grandfather about planting marijuana in someone else's garden.
Yeah.
But it's like that's exactly how your grandfather was, like real chill, whatever. I mean, he might play a joke on somebody and he might tease or whatever.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
tease.
Like loved to be sarcastic. I mean, I was his girlfriend till the day he died. Like
you're right.
You know what I mean? He's a silly guy. But when it came to things that mattered, I mean, you were.
And when it came to stories, like he wasn't a gunboat tail, you know, person wasn't like, you know, the fish didn't get bigger.
Right.
You know,
the deer. Wasn't like his brother.
Nah, the deer didn't get more antler, you know, like more points on its antlers. You know, it's just like the story was what it was.
Yeah.
And never to my mind exaggerated something. And if this guy is like that guy, I'd believe it for sure.
For sure.
And there's so many. That's what I love about like the fan submission stories, because there's so many stories out there, you know, by people trying to be authors, by people trying to, you know, launch some kind of career angle along with the story. There's plenty of those. There's things that get adapted into movies, all these things.
Sure. And that's all fine and well.
All fine. And those could be real too. Just because you have a story and you're trying to do something with it doesn't mean it's not real. But for every one of those stories, my guess is there are tens of thousands of other stories like this.
Yeah.
Where if Will had not listened to this podcast, might not have ever shared it with a podcast, and it would just stay in family lore. And I mean, there's just, I mean, it makes me think of an old history teacher I had in high school, Bob Zimmerman. Good guy. He was our college counselor. And I don't know if I've ever told this here or not. Maybe I have. But just one day in class, I don't even know how the hell it came up. Oh, I think it was during hunting season.
Mm-hmm.
And kids are getting an excuse from class to go hunting. And kids are leaving early or whatever like that in the town I grew up in to go hunting. And he just shared this story about, and it was the only story to my knowledge that he had like this. And I knew his wife and his daughter, and none of them seemed like storytellers.
Yeah.
And he just said that he was hunting on this mountain around Riggins, and the mountains around there, even if you go much further, they're heavily wooded, but there's a lot of like bare, steep mountains. So your line of sight, you can see a long way mm-hmm. down the hill, and there's a lot of old like mining homesteads and things and old ranching homesteads. So there'll be this like just a long slope with maybe a little shack on it and nothing around.
Yeah, sounds right.
And he said that clear as day, he wasn't drinking, he wasn't anything.
My God.
He saw this large humanoid figure that he at first thought was a guy, walk across the hillside.
Holy shit.
And for scale, this thing stood next to, like went right up to that little shack and then kept on moving and left. And when it was completely gone, he didn't have a scope on his rifle, so he couldn't get like a close up, but he could see far, you know, with his naked eye enough, like, oh man, this thing's standing right by the shack and its head is above the roof.
Holy crap.
So he walked down to where that roof was. He said that thing had to be at least 9 feet tall.
Oh my God.
Like just massive. And he's like, and he was laughing as he's telling the story. He goes, you can think I'm crazy. He goes, I would think I was crazy if I heard the story, but I think I saw some kind of Sasquatch.
Holy cow. I wonder in your hometown, if there's a lot of folklore stories that get passed around.
You know, and there could be, I feel like again, with like Will, there could be so many that like the kind of town I grew up in, like people I think would be mostly embarrassed to share stories like that, that they're going to be mocked.
I know, but now I want to go down there and interview some people.
I bet if you got somebody off the record, even don't use my name, if they felt comfortable with you, have some stories.
Okay, let's call the Wilsons and the Buchanans. Those are like families that have been there forever. Let's like find out.
I love the Wilsons, but Rocky is the storyteller.
Oh.
He would have.
But maybe his son. But maybe his wife.
Maybe, yeah.
Dave Buchanan's probably got stories too.
Dave Buchanan would be a guy who like, yeah, again, if he told me a paranormal story, I would believe it because he doesn't need more stories. He has people telling stories for him about all the ass whoopings he's delivered and other crazy
things
he's done.
Even I know Dave Buchanan stories. And I the first time I meet this guy, we're walking down, like Dan's from this tiny, tiny 400-person town, and we're like walking down the street and this giant human
local legend
leans over like a busted fence covered in soot. I can only see his eyes. He's like, hey Danny. And I'm like, the fuck is that?
What? Huh?
So it's just Dave Buchanan.
Bear paws for hands.
Oh my God. And such a sweet man.
Yeah.
But yeah, oh my God, how cool would it be, like just as a concept, to just go to small towns like that doing paranormal interviews, not even investigations, because it's sort of like this,
And people have done you get into the Amazon, whatever, not necessarily my default Amazon, but there are plenty of other online retailers or like bookstores, regional bookstores, and you go to the folklore section.
Yeah.
And you can find the right bookstore. And there are those little known books that someone did as a passion project.
Yeah.
Where they just collected folklore from their area. And I'm sure every country in the world has all these, you know, like little pockets, you know, and there's no shortage of stories.
Yeah. Cool. How come our books aren't in our local bookstore?
Because the whole thing.
I know. I tried. They were not interested.
Yeah. Just so much work for so little reward.
Yeah. For them. Yeah. Totally. All right. Well, do you want to do some shout outs?
I do.
Or do you want me to go first?
I'll start.
Okay. Go for it.
I'd like to thank the following Annabelles for supporting us on Patreon. And we are so thankful for people who send in stories, support us in any form. Very fortunate. Lauren Oman. Aspen Vin Gorski, Dylan J. Johnson, Trina Seplina Tomasini.
It's a lot of hard names this week, I got to tell you.
Kyle Potter.
Nailed it.
Thanks for the softball there. Thanks for the easy lob. Chunky Funky Beach. Raymond. Laura Nothdurft. Sydney Zwelly. Tracy Hilton. Lynette Joseph. Tiffany De Herrera. Courtney Rowland. David Mucky, Aveline Ramirez, Caleb White, Andrew Hardy, Nancy Flores, Olivia Rowlandson, Kayla Tweedy, Daddy Swamp Monster, Morgan M., Pat the Prostate... My God. Pat the Prostate Punisher.
Uh-huh.
All right. Chris Wrangle. And Trevor Ware.
I swear to God, I think some people are just like, they want to get you. Like,
oh, sure.
Can I get Dan to laugh?
Yeah.
All right. I'd like to thank the following Annabelles for their support on Patreon. Andrew Plants, Josu Lopez, Cheryl Weiser, Birdie Thus. I think I'm saying that right. Thus, T-H-O-O-S. Thus?
Thus, yeah, I don't know. Thus, probably.
But our niece, we call Birdie. And so I just like, I love it, Birdie. Like, I really hope that's your true name. Joel Vargas, Tamazan Johnson, Linda Tuttle, Mackenzie Barrett, Katie Bearer, Kristen Rose, Margaret McCormick, Jay, Ashley Tidwell, Andrew Sevenbergen, Logan Hooks, Two Dogs Humping, followed by Moist Man, Morgan Fitch, Kelsey Scott, Eli Ward, Casey G, Brandy Tressler, Elizabeth Harvey, Carrie Delaney, and Amanda Carlson.
Nice.
Nice. All right. Also, we have the following spoopy shout outs to Philip from Rochelle. Happy belated birthday. To Fallon from your mom, Anna. Happy 13th birthday. Also, happy birthday from me, Fallon. We're birthday twins. Mm-hmm. And to Raphael from Mary Lou. Happy belated 40th birthday. To Josh from Red. Happy birthday. Thanks for introducing me to all of this terror. You're the best. And to Zach from Brooke. Happy 12-year anniversary.
Aw, so many nice messages.
So many nice messages.
And that is our show. Thanks, everyone, for the ratings and reviews lately. They do help us continue to find new listeners and are very appreciated. So we appreciate seeing new ones. Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else at info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email Gary Busey by looking up Gary Busey online and finding his email address. Thanks to Logan Keith and Tyler C for their work on social media and to Logan again for running badmagicmerch.com. Thanks to Logan for producing and directing today, Zach Cohen for custom soundbed creation, Heather Rylander for organizing the My Story emails, and to our book editor, Drew Atana, for polishing and preparing listeners' tales for book number 4. Thanks to Sarah Finch for finding the first story I told this week and Olivia Lee for finding the second. Subscribe to Bad Magic Productions on YouTube. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram if you want more content and to see pictures that accompany the episodes at Scared to Death Podcast, or on TikTok at Scared to Death Podcast for special moments and highlights. And if you don't want to hear any ads, if you want monthly bonus episodes, check out our Patreon. Get the entire catalog, ad-free and more. Enjoy your nightmares, creeps and peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness and remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but hath no home here within. Scared to death.
Alien just takeover. Pretty exciting way to go.
But possibly very painful.
Yeah, but still, as you're dying this painful death, you're like, that's fucking alien.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Here, our waters are splashing and rejuvenating. Our history is for seeing and experiencing. Our theme parks are for riding and sometimes flying. And our great outdoors are yours for exploring and restoring. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.
Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 4/22 through 4/28. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.